must be a salary estimate of some kind to provide workers' compensation benefits for those same people. So I assume that another segment of government has already gone, you know, far enough to allow them to be included in a system that is whose contribution is based on, you know, the compensation.
Correct. I think there are some legitimate numbers that could be used. What we're suggesting here is that the reference to membership in PERS be removed, and that instead the clarification be made that volunteer firefighters coming under PERS at the request of the employer and at the approval of the board mm-hmm. be granted a length of service stipend, if you will. Mm-hmm. I've been approached by a number of volunteer firefighter organizations that have people that have that are interested in providing some sort of recognition of the long service as a volunteer firefighter, but they're not interested in providing a pension with all of the other additional benefits attached to that, like disability and death benefit, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So this provision would pave the way for that to take place. Long range, there will be most likely be volunteer firefighter associations approaching the board, asking the board to include volunteer firefighters for some length of service stipend. That will cause an administrative impact on PERS.
Any now?
Pardon me?
Are there any now?
I have been approached by several, yes. So they're waiting in the wings.
You don't have any actually involved?
No, we have no volunteer firefighters now covered.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
The third provision is on page 4, and it also on page 5, and it's quite a lengthy one. It clarifies essentially that the length of service, that the retirees' cost of living adjustments are payable also to the beneficiaries of a deceased retiree. This is merely a codification of what we are now doing. We are now paying beneficiaries of retirees the same cost of living benefit that the retiree would have gotten had the retiree still been alive.
So what we're doing is changing Section 2 to allow what we're already doing.
Yes, we are already interpreting the present statute to extend to, for example, you're retired, you take a joint survivor option, which pays to you until you die and then continues to your spouse. There's a cost of living, an automatic cost of living adjustment in the statute right now. Every July 1, we increase your benefit. If you were to die, your benefit continues to your spouse under the option you selected. That continued benefit to your spouse would also be included or increased by the cost of living adjustment, and this clarifies that that is the case.
So we really don't have a fiscal impact on this thing from now on because we're already
correct
involved.
There's no fiscal impact whatsoever.
Fine. Any questions?
I have one.
Max?
I have just one question. You're deleting Section 1 or the first paragraph of Section 2 that requires that any increases are reflected, and you're putting it down in sub 2. Is that a form and style change? And do you see any change in the language other than, do you follow what I'm saying?
I think I see what you're saying. That is merely a form and style change. I see no change whatsoever in the way we apply the statute to the particular cases.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the fourth one is, again, a clarification of the treatment of those people who are employed as teachers at Hillcrest McLaren School in the Schools for the Deaf or the Blind. This provision is a rather complicated one. It deals with how we calculate the value of sick leave at retirement time, unused sick leave at retirement time for teachers as opposed to non-teaching employees. All along, the employees at Hillcrest and McLaren School and the Schools for the Deaf and the Blind have been treated as teachers. They have never been, the specific reference to these individuals has never been placed in statute up to this point. What we want to do is clarify that and put it in statute. The fifth one is on page 9, beginning at...
Excuse me just a moment. What?
Are they all teachers out there? This is employees.
Teachers, employees.
The language says, or employees of McLaren School for Boys, so that all the employees out there that are under PERS are going to be treated as teachers?
Engaged in teaching or other school activity.
Okay.
And that language
is... What is other school activity?
You got me. I wish I could. The language other school activity is used throughout the statute when reference to teachers, and there is a dispute as to what other school activity entails. However, I don't think that this bill, the housekeeping bill, is the proper vehicle for clarifying that even further. That is a policy question.
So this keeps the language that everyone's concerned with consistent.
Consistently difficult to administer, I guess.
Okay.
Okay, the fifth provision is on page 9, on beginning on line 17.
Mm-hmm.
What we're trying to do here is allow or provide that there will continue to be an accrual of interest on the amount to be paid out between the time of death and the time of actual payout in specific cases. And what we're doing here is clarifying or standardizing the treatment on death benefit payouts for all other retirees. Lump sum payments and installments is what we're talking about here. One of the options you have as a retiree is to take a lump sum of your member account and take it installments to smooth out the impact of taxes on your
mm-hmm.
your payment. If you should die before that one of those last lump sum installments is paid out, there is no provision to accrue interest on that amount between the time of your death and the time of our actual payout. Mm-hmm. All other death benefit lump sum payouts at death do accrue interest up to the date of payout. And so what we're trying to do is standardize that.
No problem there.
Right below that, there's a provision that deals with a death prior to 1953. This is an obsolete provision, and in an effort to clean up the language, we're removing that obsolete provision.
Okay.
The seventh provision standardizes the language to prevent administrative costs associated when paying small monthly benefits on the change of the death of a member. The last legislative session changed the limit on payouts such that if your straight life benefit is $30 or less per month, we can pay you in a lump sum, the equivalent, the actuarial equivalent of that.
I remember that.
Uh-huh. What we didn't do was standardize that throughout the statutes, and right now what we're trying to do is extend that same limit on death benefit payouts. So it standardizes again. Number 8 on your summary is a provision that's obsolete, which we wish to remove, again, for clarification to clean up some of the language in the law. I don't know if I want to add any more information to that. However, I can tell you that we've never invoked this part of the statutes, to my knowledge, and to the knowledge of my staff who has historical background.
Just hold a minute.
Okay. This deals with a situation where a person makes application for a disability benefit and then dies.
Well, we have state law on this outside of this statute.
Correct, we do. We have several places in our statutes that provide for the payment of on the death of a member, either that's somebody who hasn't yet retired or somebody in the process of retiring.
Okay, the difference here is that the state deals with it as an administrator if there's no will. And
correct.
This doesn't it say, if there's no designation, then obviously, well, I guess what my question is probably if there's a will and PERS is not mentioned, where I can see where that could happen very easily.
Representative,
if the person just happens to forget, doesn't the will still cover it? Or does it?
No, we have specific statutes elsewhere in Chapter 237 that deal with beneficiaries and who stands to receive a benefit if no beneficiary is named. And this statute would go back to those, instead of having language written right here, we would go back to Chapter 237.165, which mm-hmm. provides for the husband or the wife and the children, the grandparents, mm-hmm. etc. There is a specific standard sequence in our statute. In addition to that, this particular language refers to the situation where a person applies for a disability benefit and then dies before it's been approved. On the original application, were they first applying for a disability benefit, they do name a beneficiary at this time. So we don't have people dying under application without having named a beneficiary.
Well, doesn't state law say if a person dies without a will that the children receive half of the estate and the surviving spouse does?
Representative Whitty, you're probably referring to the regular rules of death without inheritance.
Without jointly owned assets.
Correct. We have specific statutes that deal with beneficiaries. If you die without a will and you've named a beneficiary to PERS, we can still pay that our benefit to your named beneficiary. And what happens to the rest of your estate is dealt with by other statute.
If the beneficiary is deceased, then what happens?
Well, we go back to our particular statutes. We have a standard sequence that names that specifies the husband or wife if they're alive, or the children if they're alive, or the parents if they're alive, or the brother and sister if they're alive. And finally, it gets down to your estate and pays off your medical bills. In Chapter 237, 165 is the specific one that we're dealing with now. That's death on disability.
All right. So we really don't need this?
No, we don't need it. We've never used it.
Okay.
Number 9 in your summary is there are several sites that this refers to, and that is because there are several places in our statutes that talks about paying a benefit and being able to change your mind. Right now, you are given 60 days after your date of your first benefits payable.
What happens, okay? I'm going to be retiring, as you know, shortly this year. I have an idea what I want to do, but I'm really not that positive about it. I mean, I might change my mind. I might feel somewhere down there that I'm not going to live as long as I thought I was going to, and I want to do something different, maybe. You know? Right now, I feel that way, matter of fact.
Representative Whitty, you have...
It's Monday. Usually, I feel that way later on in the week.
Representative Whitty, you have, under present law, you have 60 days after your benefit first becomes payable to change your mind.
Payable.
That's the key. Okay. And that's what we're trying to change, because we know that there can be delays for one reason or another in getting that first check to you. Even though the check is payable, you don't have it in your hand. Our experience tells us that oftentimes reality of what was chosen, people say, oh my gosh, I thought I selected this, but I really selected that. They don't realize that until after they get that first check. Mm. So what we want to do is provide that they have 60 days to change their mind after receipt of the first check.
Gotcha.
All right. There is another provision in law that was written in last time around that allows you to contest the accuracy of the benefit. You have 240 days after you're notified as to how we calculate your benefit. You have 240 days to contest that. That, however, does not allow you to change your mind on the option selected unless the result of that contest of your benefit does result in a change in your benefit amount.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump back to the one we just came from, 8.
Okay.
And I don't want to go back to the page. I just want to tell you this. The attorneys on the floor of the House, when we're carrying this, whoever's going to carry this bill, are going to ask questions about that section, that change, the obsolete provision that is deleted. So, just make a note that whoever's going to carry the bill is going to have some evidence that deletion is substantiated with some kind of statement from you. So, can you give us something like that so the carrier will have?
I'll be happy
to. Some kind of whatever. This session, we are allowed in the House to have the committee administrator with us on the floor. We haven't been able to do that before this session, and we may change in the House rules to allow that. So That means that we can have our administrator on the floor with us. We can't have you, but we can have him. And he might want something, you know. I know I would if I was carrying the bill, and I might be the one that has to do it, too. So, okay, go ahead.
Number 10, it eliminates a 2% corridor, which is rather obsolete and archaic, and it was put into the bill, into the language of the statute years ago to provide or cut back
what,
on.
What page are we on?
We're on page, oh dear.
It isn't on there.
I didn't do that.
That's
for you,
all right.
I'm sorry.
What
if I can
page
find
is it?
That.
I can see why you didn't, because you had that long referral on the previous one.
Uh-huh.
If you can find it, we'll write it in.
Yes, I'll see if I can find it in here.
You see, we don't have anything for 10 as far as a reference goes.
Yeah, I was just looking.
I believe it's on page 15. We're getting close if it's not on page 15.
I don't see anything on 15 at all.
Nope.
Well, that's all right.
I'm sorry, page 16, line 32.
Oh, okay, 16, line 32. Okay, great.
Okay, right now that there's a 2% corridor, this is how it works. If you're in the variable program,
mm-hmm.
In other words, your benefit is paid under the variable, part of your benefit is paid under the variable annuity, we make an adjustment in your benefit every year based upon the experience of the variable investments.
Right.
If that increase or decrease is within 2% plus or minus of zero, that's mm-hmm. the 2% corridor we're talking about. We don't bother changing your benefit. We just carry that forward as a debit or a credit to the next year's calculation. And the reason for it is because we used to do all these things by hand. And when you have thousands upon thousands of people getting benefits and you have to make that change, that calculation, in 1 month's time and get all those new checks calculated.
Yeah. How many variable people do you have? I know it's a smaller...
Very small right now. The number's decreasing. Approximately 6% of our current retirees are in the variable program, and less than 15% of our actives were in the variable program at one point in time or another in their career.
For the committee's benefit, if you're in the variable program as far as accumulation of your cash, that doesn't necessarily mean when you retire that you continue in the variable program as an annuity or
correct.
A pension. Or you're only allowed the annuity portion to be in the variable, and the pension is not, or what?
No, the way it's calculated, we compute what portion of your benefit, your total benefit, was due to your participation in variable, and that percentage, if you decide to stay in the variable program, that percentage continues in your retirement.
So people that are in the fixed program don't have a variable option when they retire?
Correct.
All right, fine, thanks.
Right.
I didn't know that.
What we want to do here is eliminate that 2% corridor. We now do these things by computer, and there's no reason for us to not increase or decrease a person's benefit merely because the variable
okay.
may have been 1.41.
Good, we got that. Go ahead.
Okay, number 11 standardizes the treatment of state and local employers with regard to collection of reports and collection of contributions. Again, this is there's a great deal of change to the statutes themselves, but the net effect is to standardize the way in which we treat both state employers, state agencies, and local governments when contributions and reports are not received in a timely fashion. I'd be happy to go into further discussion on that. I'm not sure that you're interested.
What's the difference? Is there any difference?
Max?
There's a difference between how you're going to treat a public employer and a state agency?
Right now there is a difference the way we treat them, and what we're trying to do is standardize them.
Penalties that are intact now for failure to remit contributions or any other obligations, is that often, do you have to use it?
Yes.
And will these changes make it easier to use?
It won't make it any easier to use. It might make it financially more palatable on the larger employers. Right now, if your report is late, your annual report, we charge you 1% of the total contributions you paid in throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
That gets to be a pretty hefty figure. And what we're changing here is we're saying we're going to charge you 1% or we're going to charge you $2,000, but no more than that.
So you're putting a maximum of $2,000
on the annual report, on the reports.
On the annual report.
Right. The monthly contributions we received every month from the employers, both state and local, there's no change in that treatment. We're still going to charge them 1% for every month or portion of a month that's late.
So, but that's on a monthly basis.
That's on a monthly basis. And there are continued requests for waivers of that. We do have employers who do not get their money in on time for some very valid reasons. And there are others that don't get their money in on time for what I would consider invalid reasons.
Okay, this is per month. This is the section that we're going to have trouble with when we're carrying the bill. This is the section.
I would ask the chairman why. No employer should ever be late, so why should they have a problem?
I understand that, but there are people, I don't know where AOC and LOC are on this one. I mean, they aren't here, are they? No. Are they?
There was somebody from the...
Yeah, we do have.
LGPI.
Hey, well, there we are. Okay. Would you... Maybe we won't have a problem with it.
Representative Woody, if you permit me, I'll explain to you how this will actually help local government employers.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's say, under present law, a local government employer didn't get their final annual payroll reports to us so we could close our books. Let's say their payroll, I'm not good with numbers in my head without a calculator in front of me, but let's say their payroll is large, very large. Right now, we charge them 1% of that total contribution that they would have made throughout the year. It's just a report they haven't gotten to us at the end of the year. It's no money. It's just the report. But we're charging them 1% of the total contributions that they paid in throughout the year.
Uh-oh.
For every month or portion of a month that they're late in getting that report to us. What we're doing here is
that's just an incentive to get the information.
That is a little bit of a carrot to
finish your administrative work.
So we can close our records, correct. What we're saying here is we're going to charge them the same thing as we always have, but not to exceed $2,000. So you're very large employers who have big payrolls, and I can think of a few that were not local government, but they were more state government agencies that had terrific bills that they would have had to pay if we had levied those charges against them.
Okay, well then that's a plus. We better have a note on that, other than maybe just, let's see if this will cover it. No, it doesn't. Would you give us a little more on that
so
that we can use whatever you give us to explain that section when we are on the floor?
Be happy to.
Okay.
And the final provision on your summary has to deal with the health insurance program for retirees. When the law was promulgated, the intent was, I believe, to provide the subsidy to eligible retirees and their surviving spouse or dependent. The way the language was written is it talks about beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
Beneficiary could be a neighbor, could be a niece,
mm-hmm.
could be a brother, could be anybody. What we're trying to do is make it more specific to the spouse and the dependent. And so those changes do that.
Okay. And that's it?
That's it. Mm-hmm. Oh, excuse me, I have one other provision here that right. suggestion being made by the Department of Education. And it is, again, a housekeeping nature that I spoke with Mr. Anderson this morning briefly on advice of their counsel. They suggested that there be a further clarification made to the pickup provision in statute as it relates to employees in the Department of Education. I'll take a step back. The employer right now can elect to pick up that contribution, the 6% that you heard discussed earlier. The employer can elect to do that for tax purposes and pay it on behalf of the employee into PERS. Employees covered by the Department of Education can pay into what we call a 403B annuity. It's a TIAA CREF is, for example, one of the marketers of this 403B annuity vehicle. There is a provision in the law right now that allows for payment of contributions into TIAA CREF for individuals in the Department of Education who are eligible for this. The pickup, the contributions into TIAA craft have been picked up by the employer, by the state of Oregon, much the same as contributions and PERS have been picked up. They've been mm-hmm. treated the same. Advice of counsel is that it's not clear in the statutes that that is, in fact, something that can be done, that that is a pickup. It's subject to the same pickup provisions as the rest of our contributions. And the language being suggested by the Department of Education, I believe, would clear it up. It adds, actually, Sections 15 and 16 to the bill. I believe Mr. Anderson's here, could answer some questions if there are any further questions.
No.
I fairly represented the problem.
I thought everybody could do that, but apparently that isn't the case, huh?
The TIAA CREF contributions are specific in the statute. There's a special provision for that. And I think what the Department of Justice is suggesting is that the pickup provisions be incorporated into those statutes to make sure that...
Okay.
It's legal.
We understand this is just the employee share that is allowed to be, I assume they'd have to bargain for it, or it's just...
I don't know that it's bargained or not. Is it bargained?
Yeah. Okay, but it allows them to do that anyway.
We've been doing it all along.
Yeah, okay. Then we don't have, I guess we don't have a... There's Walden.
No impact.
Question.
What is the acronym you're using?
Pickup?
No,
TIAA CREF, a Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association College Retirement Education Fund. It's a...
You had to ask, didn't you?
It's out of New York, and it's a large company, very very much like a PERS, but it's nationwide for portability purposes.
Thank you.
Just one question.
Representative Dominey.
On the overall thing, we got this physical impact, and it says there is no impact.
Correct.
And I'm still confused with the comments down there. Early on, you said there would be some kind of an impact, in your opinion, as far as the firefighters thing is concerned.
Yes, Representative Way, Representative Dominey, the impact is not in the bill. The bill merely paves the way for volunteer firefighter employers to now request the board's approval to include them in PERS. The board could say no. Whatever is done, if in fact they are covered, it would be done, it would cost money for us to administer a special retirement provision for these volunteer firefighters. The board doesn't have that approved in their budget. They'd have to go back to the e-board and request additional funds from the e-board to allow them to do this kind of thing. The language, it's probably splitting hairs. The language that you see before you does not require us to do anything. It just paves the way so that these volunteer firefighters can begin negotiating with the board to provide coverage.
So that explains why there's no cost.
That's correct.
Until
we do it, there's nothing spent.
If you don't think it is, find some that is, and then make a change. Okay. Thank you. Any more questions? Anybody else to testify? Colleen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Colleen Haas, representing League of Oregon Cities Association of Oregon Counties.
I'm glad to have you up. You sound like me.
I was just going to say I was hoping not to testify today. Excuse me. When we finish here at 10, I'm on my way to the doctor.
I don't blame you. If I need anything in the meantime, I've got everything right here in my pockets.
For the record, I'll let that pass.
Okay.
Minister.
My concern in reading the new language on pages 17 and 18, sections subsections 4 and 5,
uh-huh.
was particularly in subsection 5. I did hear the director mention that this is limiting rather than expanding the board's ability to penalize local employers or public employers, actually, who are delinquent. However, my concern was I didn't find, and I'm not a retirement expert, I did not find in statute the language that is being amended. This looks to me to be new language. And so if it is in statute, that would be what I'd like to know. or if it is in PERS board rules or PERS administrative rules, that's certainly different than already having it in statute and changing statute. In our estimation, if it's being put into statute, that is expanding from if it was in PERS board rules only. So that was my concern, and I didn't have a chance to talk with the director ahead of time as to whether it's changing statute or putting in statutory language that is currently practiced. And if it's currently practiced, we have a concern with it and would like to discuss it further. I'm open for
any
questions.
Well, we're not going to have a work session on the bill. It's a good little old bill. Somebody might want to look at it down the line, see if we can. I like these big fat ones, you know, they're really great. You want to comment on that, Pat, at all?
Yes.
Please stay here, Colleen.
At the very end, if you notice, Section 14 repeals 237.303 and 305.
What page? Where are you?
14 is
the last page of the bill, 2049, Section 14.
Oh, yeah.
And those two sections, 303 and 305, are being repealed. That's the language that Colleen's looking for.
Okay. Oh. If you have any further concerns, you talk to Pat and Max and see if you can smooth that out.
Very fine. Thank you, Chairman.
Any questions? Thank you, Colleen. I hope things work out a little.
Oh, they will. They did last time.
Yeah, just curiously, do you have more problems when you're outside than you do inside? I sure do. Once I get outside, God.
No.
I'm hoping it rains. I think it'll take whatever's in the air out of it.
So maybe falling
into you. Surviving better. Either that or stay inside all the time. That's not a bad idea either, is it? Anybody else want to testify on 204-9, I hope?